Welcome to State of the News. I'm Rick Hellett, and we begin, as we typically do, with our WFPL News Roundtable. Joining us are Erica Peterson, Devin Katayama, and Philip M. Bailey. Gabe Bullard has an excused absence today. We want to hear from you, 502-814-TALK. That's 502-814-8255. Or you can call us toll-free, 1-877-814-TALK. That's 1-877-814-8255. You can email us at news@wfpl.org. Send us a tweet at WFPL News or reach us through our Facebook page. Philip, let's start with you. There's been a lot of talk over the past week or so about this landmark ordinance that was proposed in the Louisville Metro Council, some controversy, disagreement over it, and now it has been tabled.
Yes, the landmarks ordinance is being amended, or at least proposed amendment, by Councilman David Yates, a Democrat from District 25. Basically, the amendment changes. There's some significant changes to the city's land development code in Councilman Yates's proposal here. The current ordinance, as it stands now, requires 200 signatures from residents to petition the Landmarks Commission for protected status for any building or monument. That basically means that if you get 200 signatures from anyone within Jefferson County, the Landmarks Commission will at least hear your case. In Yates's amended version, however, you would need 51% of those signatures, so about 102, would have to come from people who either live or own property within a one-mile radius of that proposed historical site. Preservationist groups who have fought in the past to preserve and save places like Whiskey Row argue that this will favor developers, wealthy developers in particular, that there's nothing really wrong with the process. It's not broken as it is now. Councilman Yates, however, argues that the Landmarks Commission, while it does important work, there's no oversight. There's no accountability. Now, some of his colleagues have obviously pointed out that that isn't necessarily true from their standpoint, that, listen, the mayor appoints the members of this Landmarks Commission, and the council ultimately approves it. If you have a problem with how the Landmarks Commission is made up or the decision-making, perhaps the appointments committee should do a better job of vetting the candidates that the mayor proposes. So preservationist groups have obviously opposed this, and Democrats are a bit divided over this issue. But at this point, Councilman Yates does have about 8 co-sponsors. It should be pointed out that I think Councilman Yates has demonstrated that he's very open-minded with this issue. He agrees with it being tabled to have more community input. He's willing to make certain changes to amendments, but he feels pretty passionate that at this point, this panel isn't held accountable, and there are more things that need to be done to rein it in.
So when might this be brought back up?
Probably the next 2 weeks, we're going to see the public input, those public hearings. One has been scheduled for council chambers. Another one, I think, is going to be off-site somewhere out in the community. Not sure if exact location as of yet. But the next time the committee meets, I believe, is February 28th, when the Planning and Zoning Committee will meet. And that will really, we'll see the ball rolling. And then at that point, I know Councilman Tom Owen and Councilwoman Tina Warpew have opposed the legislation, their fellow Democrats. They argue that, you know, the more public input and education that council members get, the more likely this legislation will pass. Councilwoman Warpew has come out even, I think, harder, and Councilwoman Warpew has come out even harder in the sense of saying that if this legislation does pass, Mayor Fisher needs to step up and veto it.
All right. Thank you, Philip. Erica Peterson, let's turn to you. You reported this week that the Environmental Protection Agency has begun soil sampling in Louisville's Park Hill neighborhood this week. What are they looking for?
Well, they're looking for contamination. The sites they're sampling are all along Wilson Avenue and St. Louis Avenue. They're houses that have yards that back up to the Blackleaf Chemical site, which is a 29-acre industrial park kind of in the middle of the neighborhood where they manufactured a lot of different chemicals like DDT and dieldrin pretty much up until the 1950s. And so they're looking for signs of these pesticides. They found the actual Blackleaf Chemical site is contaminated. And they found signs of pesticides as well as heavy metals kind of in the alleys right outside the fence. But they're looking to see if these materials have actually contaminated people's yards as well.
So what happens if they do find some contamination?
Well, there are a variety of things that could happen. Kind of the most extreme is that the entire yard will be excavated. They'll basically come in there and remove all the dirt and fill it back in and, you know, obviously pay for re-landscaping, reseeding, things like that. But if they discover that that the levels of contamination are slight and really don't pose much of a danger to human health, they might just issue warnings, you know, tell people if they're out in their yards to, not touch their hands to their mouth, wash their hands, things like that.
So do the companies that made these materials, the pesticides, have any responsibility to clean up the site?
Well, sort of the jury is still out on that one. The problem with the site is that there were a number of companies there. The property changed hands a lot, and the pesticides were manufactured a really long time ago. So right now, according to the EPA, nobody knows who will have to pay for it if they do. I mean, obviously, the excavating measure is the most expensive one. It could fall to the federal government. It could fall to the state government, which the EPA kind of got involved because of the scope of it. It's a, you know, it's a big job. So the state of Kentucky basically asked for help. They could try to track down who is responsible for this. But it seems at this point, it's unlikely that you'll be able to find the responsible party and that there'll still be a company and things like that. So it probably will follow the taxpayers.
So the testing was conducted, they began it this week.
Yeah, they were out there. They're out there Tuesday and Wednesday, and soil sampling is a very tedious process. Mm-hmm. They had a meeting in November where they basically asked community members to come in, and they explained what they were going to be doing, and they were seeking permission. Obviously, they need permission from all right. the homeowners to test, and they got about more than 50 people gave permission. And there are about 80 homes all in all they wanted to test. So they were pretty happy with that. So they went around taking soil samples, and we'll know in about 2 months, the homeowners will know what they found.
All right. Thank you, Erica. Let's turn to you, Devin Katayama. Been a lot of talk in Frankfurt this session about charter schools, and that talk has spilled over into our local community, and Philip can talk about it as well, but you've been covering.
There's several of us this week who are kind of involved with this issue, Kenny in Frankfurt, Philip, he spoke with local leaders here, and I covered an event that happened earlier in the week. They've been really calling a lot of support for and against this charter school bill because it's the first time, at least since 2009, since Carl Rollins has been chair of the Education House Committee, that he's heard the bill in front of his committee. So this is really when all the heavy hitters are coming in with their arguments, both for and against the bill. Dr. Howard Fuller came in. He's the co-founder of Black Alliance for Educational Options. He was a keynote speaker earlier this week, and he was one who spoke in front of the House committee. What we're seeing is something interesting for the first time because of the support and because it's kind of snowballing. That certain legislators, and Philip spoke with Reginald Meeks earlier this week as well, are kind of changing their tone depending on how much of an issue it is. So the first voice that you're going to hear in this clip is Reginald Meeks and how he's kind of changing his decision, at least to hear the bill. The next voice is going to be Dr. Howard Fuller.
Charter schools offers an option. Whether it's a good option, whether it's a viable option, I think remains to be seen. I've moved to the point where I think that we at least have to have the discussion. And there's nothing wrong with discussing options and looking at what possible alternatives are for increasing the quality of our schools.
Well, I think it's significant that the people have moved this to the point where there's even a hearing. And you can't make the second step until you make the first. And so I think it is extremely significant that at least they're having a hearing, and we need to move from there. This is a long-term battle, and people need to understand that if for whatever reason it doesn't pass this year, we're not going away. And so we're going to keep pushing, and we're going to keep pushing, and we're going to keep pushing.
And I think that's really the point, is that nobody's really expecting it to get too far. It seems like that's the mood around mm-hmm. Frankfurt. However, like Mr. Fuller said, this is an issue that's probably going to be, keep coming up.
I think especially, as you say, as Representative Meeks pointed out, I mean, it wasn't too long ago where he and others were absolutely opposed to charter schools. What you see here politically is sort of a broadening coalition of conservative Republicans and liberal Democrats, particularly in the African American community, who are frustrated with the achievement gap along lines of race, who are now beginning to say it's not that we're rejecting the public school system or even blaming the public school system, but parents and constituents in our districts are chiming in more and more with, give us the options, give us more, I guess, ability to have different choices, not saying that they are going to ultimately solve disparities or gaps as far as achievement and education are concerned, but we'll never know unless we have as many, as Councilwoman Sherry Bryan Hamilton pointed out, different tools in the toolbox. Earlier this week, a bipartisan group of Louisville Metro Council members came out and signed a letter urging the General Assembly to pass the legislation this session. So while supporters want that, Representative Meeks pointed out, you know, we're still going to have these hearings just to educate state lawmakers, but there's less likely to be an actual vote on any charter school bill in committee or otherwise.
Just to be clear, charter schools are schools that would continue to get government funding, but they don't necessarily have to operate within the rules of the government. But in exchange for that, they have to show some sort of progress.
Yeah, they wouldn't be under the exact control of a school board necessarily. They would still get public funds, but they would be organized very differently, maybe with a private board and have sometimes different rules. I know, for example, CNN did a story about a charter school where they actually pay the students to attend school. They get like a $25 stipend. Mm-hmm. Half of that money goes into a savings account for the students upon graduation.
And they have to show results as a result.
To show results, certain
and if
like
they
that.
Don't show those results, they can be closed after 5 years. That's a big component of this whole thing, is that if they don't prove that they've been successful, they can easily close. And Dr. Fuller was superintendent of Milwaukee Public School System, and he said that was one thing that they just couldn't do in their schools.
All right. Thanks, Devin and Philip. You're listening to State of the News on WFPL. Philip, let's turn back to you because interesting development, political development this week regarding Representative Reginald Meeks. He will have a challenger in the Democratic primary who's also president of the Tea Party.
He will have a very interesting challenge, something you see very rarely in this country. Wendy Caswell, she's a 27-year-old waitress here in Louisville. She's also the Tea Party founder and president of the Louisville Tea Party, and she's also a Democrat, considers herself to be a liberal Democrat, in fact. She says that she has conservative views on fiscal issues, but that socially she's a liberal. It's rather interesting, you know, when we interviewed Representative Meeks about this, he sort of laughed at the idea of a Tea Party Democrat. When I got a chance to talk to Wendy Caswell, I asked her, how is it that she's able to navigate politically, both in the Tea Party and as a Democrat, when those seem to be contradicting terms?
There's definitely, you know, I have to explain myself, not a lot of the time, but some of the time, to people who, you know, don't grasp that there can be a Democratic Tea Party person or a Democrat fiscal conservative. So I definitely feel like, you know, I have to explain myself some of the time, but I also feel like I'm more representative of a regular person that's just, you know, on the streets, living their lives, watching the news, that's, you know, that's sick of the bickering, sick of both parties. There's so much stuff going on out there that I feel like I am middle America that, you know, that wants to see some fiscal reforms, wants to see our legislators work together and, you know, start doing their jobs like they're supposed to be doing, representing the people.
When I asked Representative Meeks if that's a contradiction in terms, he laughed. I'm assuming some people will also say that, too. What's your response to that?
Well, I am a serious person about this race. I really feel like there are some philosophical differences between myself and Representative Meeks. I don't think it's right to laugh. Everybody has their own political beliefs, and every one of them is different. So people shouldn't be, you know, forced into these boxes that the media wants to put them in. Everybody's got different views, different things that are important to them. And, you know, I definitely feel like I will have a voice in this race, and there will be people in the community that are going to attach to me and my message.
And polling numbers show that about 15% of Tea Partiers were Democrats or still identify as Democrats. You always hear about the Tea Party having these disaffected Democrats. Caswell is different. She's not a moderate Democrat or a conservative Democrat. She might be on fiscal issues, but she supports gay marriage. She's pro-choice. I mean, she's a liberal who happens to be not just a member of the Tea Party, but the founder and the president of the Tea Party here in Louisville. It'll be very interesting to see how she balances her position in the Tea Party as its leader, but at the same time, how she will appeal to Democratic voters in a primary against an entrenched incumbent.
All right. Thank you very much, Philip. We're going to finish with a couple of airport items here. Erica, let's start with you. The Airport Authority moved forward this week with a study of some areas around Bowman Field. What's going on there?
Well, there are new FAA regulations, which could necessitate the removal of some trees in the neighborhoods or the trimming of some trees. The airport really isn't sure which. So they voted unanimously this week to basically continue with that study.
I see. How many trees could this involve?
Well, they don't know yet. It could be anywhere. Some people who live in the neighborhoods, and of course, these are kind of older neighborhoods around Bowman Field, which have a lot of mature trees, are saying it could be 1,000 trees. I think some of the council members who represent those districts went up to look at the area, too, in a plane, and they said, oh, it can't be that many. But they won't really know until they do the study. And that's what they passed, you know, on this. And I think it's important to note that they don't, according to Skip Miller, the executive director, they don't really have much of a choice. If they want to keep operating the airport as they have, I mean, letting planes land in the rain and at night and stuff, they really do need to follow the FAA regulations. So if the regulations say a tree needs to be removed, they're going to have to do it.
All right. Thanks, Erica. Devin, got about a minute left on somewhat related note. The TSA has announced it is installing new security scanners at the airports here in Louisville and in Lexington.
Yeah, these are scanners you may have seen if you've been to a lot of other very big airports. It's the full-body scanners. Mm-hmm. There's two different types of those full-body scanners, and one type really got kind of a bad name right at the get-go because it was displaying a full kind of your own body image right on the screen, and of course, you know, anything that you may have on your person. The body scanner that's going to be in Louisville and Lexington airports is basically just a drawing of a body image, you know, so like a kid's drawing or a mm-hmm. cookie cutter image is what they say. And it will display basically a red area if there's something that is detected. And it's not just metal. It's going to be able to detect wood, plastic, gels, anything that could be used in some sort of explosive, you know, situation. This will also be used in addition to the metal detector. So they'll both be used.
Mm-hmm. Are they in place now, these new machines?
They won't be in place until a few weeks. They're kind of keeping it on the down low about when they're actually going to be installing them. They have said soon, though, and a few weeks is the estimated time.
All right, that's going to wrap up our Metro segment. We're out of time. Thanks to Philip M. Bailey, Devin Katayama, and Erica Peterson. Have a great weekend, guys.
Thanks.
Time for a break. When we return, we'll visit with Kentucky Public Radio Capital Bureau Chief Kenny Colston. This is State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett. Well, the 2012 Kentucky General Assembly grinds on, some might say rolls on, and here to talk about it is Kentucky Public Radio's Capital Bureau Chief Kenny Colston. Hey, Kenny, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Legislators have the day off again today? Or?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's starting to be just every Friday. Let's make it a long weekend.
Okay. And I assume they'll be off on Monday as well, or will
That's
they?
Right, for the President's Day holiday, so it's a nice four-day weekend for them.
All right. Well, let's start with one of the big issues of the session. Pseudoephedrine and this battle to eradicate methamphetamine production in Kentucky, this bill that's making its way through would require a prescription for pseudoephedrine and it's used in cold medicines. Where do we stand now?
Yeah, the bill passed the Senate committee this week on Thursday, and a pretty narrow vote, 6-5. In fact, it was quite funny. A lot of people in the committee who have been following this were starting to watch who was leaving the room, who was entering the room for a while. Senator Carol Gibson, who voted for the measure, he had to step out of the room for about 20 minutes. So people thought it might deadlock 5-5. Senator Katie Stein, who's against the measure, walks out the room, so everyone thinks it's a slam dunk. It's a real tight, real controversial issue. There's a lot of money being poured in on both sides to get their way, and it's, you know, it's led to heated arguments, it's led to accusations. It's a tough bill, and it's a tough issue for people really to get around.
So who are the players on each side? You have law enforcement on the side. We want to eradicate, you know, meth. We have to clean up these labs all the time. And then on the other side, I assume the pharmaceutical companies.
Right. You have the Consumer Healthcare Products Association. Both sides are spending money, are having radio ads, you know, for or against their measure. And, you know, a lot of advocacy groups, a lot of citizen groups are talking about also they're not in favor of the bill and what it's doing because, you know, they say it takes away from law-abiding citizens or, you know, people with asthma or allergies who need Sudafed on a daily or weekly basis, you know, to make it tougher for them. So it really is a tough issue. Law enforcement says you have to have it if we're going to crack down on this. But the funny thing is they want to make it available by prescription only. The thing in Kentucky is prescription pill abuse is probably more prevalent and worse off than meth or, you know, any other type drug production and use. So there's a lot of it really gets down in the weeds and it's really controversial and people get really emotional about the issue.
So, as you said, it has passed a Senate committee, goes to the Senate floor. What are its prospects of winning passage?
You know, the funny thing is I don't think anyone really knows. I think there's a lot of squishy votes there. Even the sponsor of the bill, who's the majority floor leader, Robert Stivers, who would know what his membership once and would count those votes, says he doesn't know if it can pass this full Senate. I mean, barely got out of committee, you know, and that committee has a lot of Eastern Kentucky legislators who are in favor of the prescription-only abuse or use. Mm-hmm. And when you go to the full Senate, you get a lot of Louisville lawmakers, a lot of Northern Kentucky lawmakers who say, we think this is too much for this issue. So it's really up in the air. And even if it passes the Senate, it's going to be a close vote, one or two votes. And then it has to go through the House. And it hasn't played out in the House yet either. So it has to do the same motions in that chamber. I don't know that the pseudoephedrine as prescription-only bill can pass this session based on all those roadblocks.
Let's move on to charter schools, which we touched on during our Metro segment. Been a big issue in this session. Anything still possible as far as establishing charter schools in this session? Or is
it gonna be I think it probably will not make it through a House committee because it probably won't come up for a vote. Originally, House Education Chairman Carl Rollins said that if he hears a bill, he allows it for a vote. I think he's stepped back from that a little bit. Of course, the Senate passes a charter school bill every session, so there's no worry on that side of the hallway what can get done. The battle is really in the House, and it really is starting to be a battle now. Both sides are picking up their respective steam. They're gearing up, and they're arguing this issue in the House Education Committee. I think it'll get a few more hearings, and at the end, could Rollins decide to let a vote on the bill? He could. He's not in favor of the bill. So if he lets a vote, to me, that says he knows it's going to die. But if he doesn't allow a vote, that may allow charter school advocates to work a whole nother session to get those votes.
Let's talk about Governor Steve Beshear's proposal for a constitutional amendment on expanding gambling in Kentucky. What's going on with that measure?
Well, of course, that was released earlier this week, and immediately out of the gate, to use a horse racing term, it stumbled. It was bumped. Almost immediately, House Speaker Greg Stumbo, who was with the governor at his press conference to unveil the amendment, says, I have serious questions about it. Obviously, Senate President David Williams is rallying and saying, I don't support this, and I think it has a load of questions, both statutorily and constitutionally. And so now you're seeing State Senator Damon Thayer, the sponsor in the Senate, saying we might change it a little bit if the governor wants to. The governor's saying we might change it. Stumbo says, if it's going to pass my chamber, it's definitely going to change. And the problem really relies on the 60 miles in the bill. You cannot have a casino within 60 miles of a horse racing track, which really makes it difficult to have a casino anywhere in the state other than the London Corbin area. And then it also, it protects the horse racing industry with 5 guaranteed casinos at racetracks. And a lot of people are nervous about what they're calling the constitutional guarantee for racetracks. How can you give private businesses a guarantee in the Constitution? That opens up a wide range of options that they really don't want to tackle.
We've been down this road before with gambling proposals, and the big stumbling block has also always been the Senate and President David Williams. Is there a chance that we'll get a vote in a hearing this time?
I think so. I think it's going to get a vote in the state and local government committee, and I think it can pass that committee. And I don't think that a lot of people in Frankfort say the issue's already dead. I don't subscribe to that. I think there's a lot of squishy votes in the middle in that chamber. I think there's some people who can vote yes, depending on how it's worded. And, this may actually be a gamble to put all this wording out now to be able to get that compromise. Maybe they were a few votes short. They put this proposal out there. It gets people talking. You start compromising. And all of a sudden, you latch on those few extra votes in the Senate that Beshear may not have had. That's a gamble, maybe, he's taking. But at the same time, I actually think if it's going to pass, it's going to pass this session. And I still believe there's that hope. There are those that say there is no hope for this gambling amendment, though.
It's been a big issue for Governor Beshear. Of course, he ran on it and has been pushing it. And a big issue for Mrs. Beshear, Jane Beshear, has been this dropout bill that would raise the dropout minimum or the dropout age in Kentucky. It is advancing, but you reported this week that its prospects are uncertain.
Yeah. The funny thing is that it's advanced more so than it ever has in previous sessions. The House has passed the version that we most know about, the one that the First Lady advocates about gradually raising that age and not allowing people to sign out or drop out their kids at 16 years old, firmly cementing it at 18 years old. That passed the full House last night. The funny thing is a dropout bill has passed the Senate, but it's got a lot of changes from what the First Lady has proposed. So they're going to work through those changes, I think. She's going to try to. The governor's going to try to. But there are some major differences. Of interesting note is that House Education Chairman Carl Rollins, who we spoke about earlier, has scheduled that Senate bill for a hearing in his committee. So that's interesting. They might try to do a committee sub and put the old language back in there. Maybe they pass the Senate bill as a compromise and that works. It's a little uncertain, but I would say in this time, it's a good uncertain. Whereas when you talk about most bills being uncertain, it's kind of a bad uncertain.
All right. Kenny Colston is Capitol Bureau Chief for Kentucky Public Radio. Kenny, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This is State of the News on WFPL. Filmmakers from all over the U.S. and abroad are gathering at Louisville's Clifton Center this weekend for the fourth annual Derby City Film Festival. Mother's Red Dress is one of the 56 films selected for screening. It's a story about a young man who leaves home after seeing his mother kill her abusive boyfriend. John Paul Rice is a film producer who grew up in Louisville. His company, No Restrictions Entertainment, produced Mother's Red Dress. In a conversation with WFPL's Graham Shelby, Rice talked about the film and his company's unusual mission.
Your company, No Restrictions Entertainment, has as its mission to make films that deal with social issues, that entertain, and have emotional impact. Mm-hmm. How do you balance those two?
In our films, it's the narrative. It's a very delicate balance because you don't want to do things that are preachy to people, kind of hitting them over the head with an issue, but let them slowly get involved with the story through the journey of the characters and get emotionally involved, and then at the end have a point or a message to it that we believe is true.
Tell me about this movie, Mother's Red Dress.
Mother's Red Dress is a tragic love story that is about a young man who's suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. He has just witnessed his mother killing her abusive boyfriend. He leaves home to rebuild his life and becomes hopeful when he meets a young girl by the name of Ashley, who inspires him to go to college, get a job. His mother gives him a call and tells him that she's dying of cancer and wants to see him one last time before she dies. We created this story because we felt incredibly compelled and inspired by the enormous resilience that human beings have to live and move past trauma, and that there is a hope in healing when you face the truth.
How do you put together the money to make a film like this?
For these kind of films, what we do is we get involved with people that have the same kind of value system that we do, and they're looking to do something that is different than just investing in a film or making money. Of course, we always want to get our investors their money back, and we have a plan for that with distribution. But the majority of people that get involved with us, I mean, we've done everything from Kickstarter, doing crowdfunding online, where we raised $20,000 in 60 days, to friends and family and friends of friends, people that we've known for years, some of them that, oh, wow, you guys make movies, and then they see them and they're like, what's your next film? And, it's not as easy as just writing a check, but, friends and family are probably the primary source. And then there's a couple of outside investors that, like what we're doing.
A more traditional film production company might measure their film success, largely in terms of dollars earned. Given the social mission of your company, how do you measure success?
Measure success by the people that it affects, the people that enjoy the movie. You see it in people's faces when you talk to them, the reviews you read, the comments that are made. One of the things that we're doing right now is we're working with local city leaders as well as organizations for preventing child abuse, families that deal with domestic violence and mental illness. And I'm really inspired by the fact that so many people in this community, in my hometown, are looking to get involved with this film and find ways that we can do an outreach program in the community. Social change takes one person at a time. It's not something that can be immediately quantified like box office, but it's watching the lives that you affect in how they may start to begin on their own journey to help themselves.
John Paul Rice is the producer of the new film Mother's Red Dress. He spoke with WFPL's Graham Shelby. Mother's Red Dress will be screened tomorrow, 2 p.m. at the Clifton Center as part of the Derby City Film Festival. You're listening to State of the News on WFPL. I'm Rick Hallett, and we're going to turn our attention now to some religious news and issues. And joining us is Peter Smith, who writes about religion for the Courier-Journal. Peter, welcome back.
Good to be here.
Well, let's start with the Archdiocese of Louisville and Archbishop Joseph Kurtz. He made a trip recently to the Vatican to meet with Pope Benedict. Any indication as what they talked about?
Nothing in great depth. This is a routine visit that bishops make. Every bishop makes a trip, usually in company with a group of other bishops every 5 years, called an ad limina visit. It's basically a state of the diocese. They give an update to the Pope. They also meet with various other leaders of various congregations in the Vatican and go on various pilgrimage sites. He's actually back there again, made another return trip, this time to witness the making of some new cardinals tomorrow. Kurtz is vice president of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, and the president is the Archbishop of New York City. He'll be made a cardinal tomorrow.
Father Kurtz is not in line at this point to
not
be
at
a cardinal,
point,
but there has been talk that he's a good prospect, I guess.
If he were to go to a larger archdiocese, not being in Louisville.
And we have, 200,000 members in Louisville, but Chicago, for example, is up in the millions, so
right. He
would have to be at a larger denomination. You also reported recently that that Archbishop Kurtz reiterated his position on outdoor weddings for Catholics. I didn't know that they had this rule, but you must get married inside the church.
His view is, or what he says is the church teaching, is that a marriage is, it's a sacrament. It's making a pledge not just to each other, but to the community. And as he said, if they have children, it's also kind of a pledge going forward to them, a very solemn commitment. And so he said it should be done in a sacred place, a public place, which would mean in a church, not on a beach or not in a hot air balloon. He brought up some of these alternatives in a recent broadcast that he does each month on the Archdiocese's website and on the local faith channel. And he said, these are very popular for people. Maybe they have good intentions, but that's not the way we do things.
Come to think of it, having grown up Catholic, I don't recall ever being in an outdoor wedding, a Catholic wedding. So.
And I don't ever recall going to one now that you mention it.
And I've never been to one in a hot air balloon, for that matter, either, Catholic or otherwise.
So. And I have.
Oh, you have, really?
Yes, I have.
Oh, I bet that was an adventure.
Yes, well, I was on the ground.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, let's turn our attention to the Presbyterian Church. You've also reported recently that there is a new Presbyterian denomination. Now, is this affiliated with the Louisville-based Presbyterian Church USA, or is this someone who has split off?
It would be disaffiliating from the Louisville-based Presbyterian Church USA, which is the kind of the main trunk of Presbyterianism in the United States, has about 2 million members, and as they will lament, steadily declining. For years had theological battles between, particularly between liberals and conservatives, over a variety of issues, but it always front and center has been the debate over the role of gays and lesbians in the church, whether the church should ordain them and or bless their unions or weddings. And this was debated for decades. And finally, last year, the denomination, there were enough regional presbyteries that approved a constitutional amendment that changed the policy to allow gays and lesbians who are in same-sex relationships to be ordained. They still have not settled the issue of gay marriage, but that is already being debated and has been, but it's sure to come up again. In response, a number of conservative congregations are organizing, and what they're trying to do is sort of organize a couple of options for disaffected churches. One is a fellowship that would sort of have one foot in the denomination and one foot out. So if a church said, well, we don't like the way the denomination is going, but we don't want to leave, they would have this fellowship as sort of an alternative way of relating to the wider body of Presbyterians without actually having to leave the denomination. And for those that do want to leave, they set up a new denomination, the Evangelical Covenant Order of Presbyterians, which would be not the first splinter denomination. There have been other splits from the main branch of Presbyterianism. There's the Presbyterian Church in America, the Evangelical Presbyterian Church, which broke off at different times. And a number of congregations have already left for those denominations. This one would be a little different. It would be a little more affirming of women in ministry and of kind of the current theological statements of the Presbyterian Church, but separate on issues such as gay ordination.
Is this group based in Florida, or is this just where the it was established?
That's where it was announced and established at a big conference in Orlando several weeks ago. A lot of the organizing is taking place actually right here in Louisville through a group called Presbyterians for Renewal, which has been active for years as conservative advocacy and also kind of fellowship within the denomination, and now they're active in this effort as well.
You also reported that there's a possible compromise, for lack of a better term, to accommodate an Amish group that has refused to use state-mandated safety triangles on their horse-drawn buggies.
That seems to be going through with a lot of broad-based support. The issue is that there is one branch of the Amish that, for theological reasons, refuses to use the bright triangle, which is the state-mandated emblem for slow-moving vehicles. And there's legislation that passed the Senate unanimously that would allow them instead to use reflective tape on the rear and on the sides and the front of the buggy to make it visible to headlights from quite a distance. That's similar to compromise measures allowed in other states where there are large Amish populations and Kentucky's population is growing. So that's pending now in the House. There's also a pending Supreme Court case that would also challenge the constitutionality of the law that mandates the use of the triangle.
What is it about the triangle that they find objectionable?
One is that it's a symbol, period, and trusting in any man-made symbol is something they don't want to do. Another is some of them view the triangle as a symbol of the Holy Trinity, so it's not only a symbol but to them a graven image. And then third, it's bright, and they have a modesty code against using bright colors, wearing them, furnishing with them.
Well, some of them have been hauled into court and prosecuted for this. What is the status of those cases?
Well, I believe no one is in jail right now, but yeah, there have been, particularly there were two waves of cases in Graves County, where several of them spent anywhere between, I believe, 3 to 13 days in jail. And there have been a scattering of other cases in Grayson and Logan counties, and they've continued to prosecute these cases even as this legislation and the Supreme Court case have moved forward.
All right. Peter Smith writes about religion and related issues for the Courier-Journal. Peter, thanks for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
We're going to take another break. We'll be back in a moment. This is State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett. There are signs the economy is improving, but people are still looking for any way to help businesses grow in communities. There is one asset in our economy that is sometimes overlooked or seen as controversial: immigration. That perception is starting to change, though, and Dustin Dwyer has this report for us for Changing Gears.
In many ways, the headquarters for Eastern Floral in Grand Rapids, Michigan, is like a factory. It's in an old building with brick walls. The floor is smooth, cold concrete. A noisy printer rattles off new orders. But of course, it smells amazing in here. Designers stand at long wooden tables primping and pruning flowers. Red tulips, white daisies, yellow roses, and just about any other flower you can imagine. Bing Goey, the owner, says this work is more like artistry.
I think you have to be born with that.
You weren't.
I was not. I admit it.
But what Goey was born with turned out to be its own asset. He was born with a foreign birth certificate. His parents were Chinese. He was born in Indonesia, then moved to the Netherlands. From there, they moved to Grand Rapids like a lot of Dutch people before them, except they have a Chinese name. And like many of those immigrants before him, Goey worked hard. He started in the flower business in high school. Now Eastern Floral has 7 locations, about 60 year-round employees, twice that around Valentine's Day, and the company has over $5 million in annual revenue. Goey says being an immigrant and being an entrepreneur, there's a connection there.
Almost every immigrant that comes to this country has come because they see America as that that land of opportunity. So immediately their drive is to fulfill that dream.
The data on this backs Goey up.
The data from the Kauffman Foundation says that immigrants are twice as likely than American-born to start a business.
This is Richard Herman. He's an immigration attorney in Cleveland. Herman and Cleveland Plain Dealer reporter Robert Smith wrote a book called Immigration, Inc. Herman could go on all day with stats about how entrepreneurial immigrants in the U.S. are.
Immigrants are filing patents at a 2-to-1 ratio than American-born. Immigrants are more likely to have advanced degrees than American-born.
In Silicon Valley, half of the tech companies were founded by immigrants. In Ohio, that rate is about 14%. It's 17% in Indiana, 27% in Illinois, and 33% in Michigan. Nationwide, 40% of today's Fortune 500 companies were founded by immigrants or the children of immigrants, like Steve Jobs. Immigration is controversial in this country right now because of added social service and enforcement costs, and because many believe unemployed American-born people could fill some of the jobs taken up by immigrants. But in study after study, the data all points in one direction. Immigrants create more jobs than they take. In the Midwest, at least, policymakers are starting to take notice.
I'm not into the politics of immigration.
Michael Finney heads up the Michigan Economic Development Corporation.
The facts of immigration says it's good any place in the United States. The politics of it obviously say something different. And I think there's just an awful lot of confusion with respect to the kind of immigration that's really good for the United States.
Finney says his office does work to increase opportunities for people born here.
But we'd be remiss if we decided to ignore or work against the immigrant population, particularly those that are, you know, educated at our universities, and in many cases, they're earning advanced degrees. And after completing those advanced degrees, we're requiring them to leave the United States and go back to their country and compete against us.
Retaining and attracting immigrants has become a major focus for Finney and the man who hired him, Michigan Governor Rick Snyder. They've started an initiative called Global Michigan. More programs like it are popping up in the Midwest. In the next story for our series, we'll look at some of those efforts. The hope is investing in immigrants will pay off, like it has many times before in this country. For Changing Gears, I'm Dustin Dwyer in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Changing Gears is a public media collaboration among Michigan Radio in Ann Arbor, WBEZ in Chicago, and IdeaStream in Cleveland. Support for Changing Gears comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And we're joined now here on the State of the News at WFPL from Grand Rapids by Dustin Dwyer. Dustin, welcome.
Thanks, Rick.
Great piece. And we've all long heard the complaints, as you mentioned in the piece, that immigrants come into this country and take jobs that could be otherwise filled by Americans, but that appears not only to be a myth, but, you know, the opposite is true.
Yeah, I think this is, you know, we have to divide what we talk about when we talk about immigrants. There are a couple of different complaints that people have, but if the complaint is that immigrants take jobs, it just hasn't been found, and most of the data that I looked at, it seems pretty, the evidence seems pretty solid that immigrants are actually creating jobs in this country, not taking them. The analogy would be, as one of the people I spoke to for the story told me, if you think immigrants are coming in, you know, and we're all trying to eat this pie, and they're taking a slice of the pie and eating it for themselves, that's not what's happening. They're coming in and making the pie bigger so that everyone has a bigger slice of pie.
Now, you visited a flower shop operation. Are there other types of industries, businesses, where immigrants are also creating jobs?
Well, pretty much every industry, immigrants are creating jobs, and that's always been the case in the United States. One of the things that we looked at in the piece in terms of the stats, it's true that immigrants create a huge portion of the tech and engineering jobs in this country. You heard the stat in the piece that in Silicon Valley, the tech and engineering companies, 50%, more than 50% in Silicon Valley were founded by immigrant entrepreneurs. At least one of the founding members of the company was an immigrant. In Michigan, where I live, that number is 33%, so it's still pretty high. So particularly skilled immigrants come in and found a lot of our software companies, a lot of our engineering companies, a lot of companies like that. But really, if you're talking about what kinds of businesses immigrants found, they found all kinds of businesses.
Now, are these entrepreneurs from various parts of the world? Are they from, or you get a majority of them from a particular part of the world?
The Kauffman Foundation has looked into this, and when they look at just tech companies, they find that a lot of the immigrants are coming from Asia, particularly from India, which is probably not a surprise to a lot of our listeners. But again, if you're in all different kinds of industries, there's all different types of immigrants who are creating jobs. if you look further back in our history, there were here in the upper Midwest in particular, there were a lot of Eastern European immigrants who started companies. Where I live in Grand Rapids, the immigrant population is largely a lot of Dutch immigrants. And in fact, Bingoe from my story, he's of Chinese descent, but he came to Grand Rapids by way of the Netherlands. So around here where I live, a lot of the companies were started by Dutch immigrants.
Dustin Dwyer's with Michigan Radio, based in you're based in Grand Rapids, and
yep.
Been producing these pieces for the Changing Gears project. Dustin, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Take care.
All right, you too.
This is State of the News on WFPL. We're going to wrap up with some news out of Oldham County, where residents of the LaGrange area are dealing with a loud, messy, smelly problem caused by starlings, tens of thousands of them. The birds are roosting in a particular spot, flying over the area in a huge dark cloud. The residents have gone to battle against the birds, and here to tell us about how that's going is the Courier-Journal's Emily Hagedorn. Hi, Emily.
Hi.
Welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So starlings have been known to congregate like this in various areas here in Kentucky and elsewhere. Is there any clue as to what attracts them to a certain spot?
Well, with this spot in particular, it's more in a valley, which kind of shelters it from the wind, and it's facing a certain way where it gets less of the cold wind and more sun. It's close enough to fields where during the day they can go out and pick the fields for grain and corn that's fallen on the ground. And it's close enough to people to where if they can't get that food, they can go into garbage or whatnot and find food that way.
What are starlings exactly? Are they a type of blackbird? What are they?
It's a small bird. It's not the blackbirds are separate from what I've been told, but they're smaller birds. Actually, some of them are pretty looking, but they're a little bit smaller, and they actually came from Europe. Some Shakespeare enthusiasts in the late 19th century decided, because they were mentioned in a Shakespeare play, that they wanted to bring every bird mentioned in Shakespeare over to the United States, and so they brought the starlings over, and they kind of just took off.
Wow, that's interesting. Didn't know that. That is very interesting. On a serious note, they can cause some serious health problems in these numbers.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest problem is histoplasmosis, which is caused by a fungus in the ground, and when the droppings fall, it can cause issues. But most people who get infected by this show no symptoms, and the ones that do, it's usually flu-like. I mean, of course, if you have compromised immune system, if you're older or younger, it could cause more serious problems. But that's what health officials say is the biggest problem caused by this.
So what are they doing in the Oldham County to move these birds away?
Well, actually, the birds have moved, from what I've been told, for the most part. They moved about 3 miles away, now they're not in the city of LaGrange anymore, but in the county. And from what I hear, they're not, annoying residents as much as they were before. But what they did to move them is some of the residents reached out to the Kentucky Department of Agriculture, and the Department of Ag gave them these big noise cannons to shoot at the birds to try to scare them away, and so the neighbors think that it worked. But the question will be what happens next year if they come back. And at the last LaGrange City Council meeting, the City Council voted to spend money to buy, I believe, up to 4 noise cannons just in case they come back next year.
Now, you've posted some dramatic video on your guys on the Courier-Journal website of this big, it looks like a swarm of locust.
it's really you sit out there, you know, forever waiting, thinking nothing's going to happen, and all of a sudden they all come in and kind of swoop in. It was really interesting to see. I mean, I know that it's been a big headache for the residents out there, but just as, you know, to see this, you know, form of nature kind of come up, it was really kind of interesting and exciting to kind of see it happen.
Any idea exactly, well, you can't count exactly, but an estimate of how many birds are involved here?
I talked to one of the state's, bird experts, and he went out there at one point and saw them, and he estimated in the tens of thousands, but they can reach, you know, some of the roosts, you know, can be, you know, 100,000 birds, a million birds. So might be lucky that this is maybe a little bit on the smaller end. It's just that it's, you know, bugging some nearby residents.
Now, do officials say if these birds get shooed away or scared away, will they just gather at another location?
Right. They could just hop over to the next neighborhood. Supposedly these came from, or there's a thought that maybe these were the birds that were roosting next to, I believe, Blankenbaker Parkway at one point, and then they found Oldham County. So that's the worry. You get rid of them in one place, but they could go to someplace even worse.
Yeah, you've been talking to some residents out there. I assume they're fairly exasperated by all this.
Oh, yeah, and it smells terrible. If the night that I was over there, you could definitely smell, the bird droppings, which I can imagine having to live by that, would not be a very nice atmosphere to be in.
All right, Emily Hagedorn has been covering the starling mess over in Oldham County. Emily, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That's all the time we have for today's program. For more information about topics discussed on State of the News, visit our website, WFPL.org. State of the News is produced by the WFPL news staff, which includes Gabe Bullard, Erica Peterson, Philip M. Bailey, Devin Katayama, Graham Shelby. Our production team is led by Laura Ellis and Brad Yost. I'm Rick Howlett. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend.